The Tom Woods Show, episode 496.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, there's an excellent case to be made for buying gold for the long haul, but we shouldn't forget about silver, according to Peter Schiff and the folks at Schiff Gold, who have just released a free report, The Powerful Case for Silver. Check it out at tomwoods.com/silver. Welcome to the Tom Woods Show. Today we are talking about Wilsonianism, because I read an article by Paul Gottfried in the Journal of Libertarian Studies not long ago. And I thought, wait, you know, come on, for heaven's sake, we got to talk to Paul about this. This is 25-year anniversary of this article. And it's great. And I love talking to Paul. So two and two made four. And here we are talking to Paul Gottfried, who is a historian who holds a PhD from Yale University. He is Professor Emeritus of Humanities at Elizabethtown College. He's the author of numerous books, including Multiculturalism and the Politics of Guilt, Leo Strauss and the Conservative Movement in America, The Strange Death of Marxism, and Conservatism in America. Before I bring Paul back on, I want to tell you folks, I realized I hadn't done this yet, that the website for Contra Krugman is up. The website, or at least a landing page, is up at ContraKrugman.com. Those of you who have been listening for a while will know that's the podcast Bob Murphy and I are starting very, very soon, where every single week, it'll be a weekly podcast, we will critique Paul Krugman's New York Times column. And we're just going to keep on doing it. We're going to teach economics by refuting Paul Krugman week after week. So do check that out. There's a really neat video up at ContraKrugman.com, so do please check that out. All right, Paul Gottfried, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's another case of, yesterday I was talking about an article by Anthony Flew that appeared years ago in the Journal of Libertarian Studies. I just was going back, looking through old issues, thinking of maybe there are some good gems in here, some topics that I can discuss on the show. So I thought Anthony Flew would be a good guy to talk about. And then I came across your article, Wilsonianism, The Legacy That Won't Die, and I realized it's from 1990, so the article is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. So I thought, in honor of that, let's have you on
right
to talk about it. I love when books and articles have anniversaries, because it makes me feel old.
Right.
So anyway, so let's talk about Wilsonianism. I mean, I'm pretty sure most people listening have a sense of what we're talking about, but especially for the overseas people, although probably the people on the receiving end of Wilsonianism know it even better than the Americans. But give me a working definition of what we mean when we say somebody is a Wilsonian.
Well, I think in the American context, it means that that person believes in what is called liberal internationalism in foreign affairs, that the United States must impose its power together with other democracies, meaning particularly England. And since the neoconservative association with Israel, it's now Israel sort of part. So England and Israel, but particularly England and the English-speaking world, must together impose our vision of the world on other countries that are seen as less well-developed in terms of their political consciousness. That is to say, we have a moral duty as an exceptional nation, which is a term that I hear most of these Republican candidates for the presidency using, we have a moral duty to make other countries like ourselves, and if this does not happen, these countries can become a danger to our way of life. Moreover, if we fail to carry out this moral mission, people are going to languish in superstition and political backwardness. So what Wilsonianism is sort of what I think Edmund Burke referred to as an armed doctrine that he associated with the French Revolution. It's simply an updated version of that. And I think by now, although it goes back to and is associated with Woodrow Wilson, I think you and Richard Gamble and other scholars have pointed out that there is a very long tradition or very long genealogy for Wilsonianism, going back, one might say, even to the founding of the United States, that the United States is an exceptional nation and that it has a duty to make other countries like itself.
is it the case, in your opinion, that Wilson sincerely believed these things, given that he apparently made numerous exceptions over the course of his life, particularly, obviously, in the case of the Treaty of Versailles,
right,
where he had talked about, he had denounced the existing standards of international political conduct,
right,
and then he joined in that exact kind of behavior? Was some people, his apologists would say, well, he was outnumbered at the conference and there was only so much he could do and he did the very best he could. Is this a case of he was just outnumbered and he did the best he could? Or is it a case of he believes his principles when it's convenient for him? How do you sort that out?
Well, I think it is impossible, as I've argued in a long article I wrote in Historically Speaking on the relation between the old WASP patriciate in the United States and the neoconservatives, it is impossible to separate Wilson's ideals from his Anglophilia. And once World War I begins with his loathing of the countries that dare to fight England, particularly the Germans, so that for Wilson, maintaining Anglo-American world supremacy is inextricably wrapped up with his vision of a global democracy, or the entire world being transformed to look like the United States. I think in the Treaty of Versailles, it's true that he does give in on certain points, but I think that his support of one side in the war as the righteous side, I think a point that Richard Gamble makes in his book The War for Righteousness, and his view of the other side is totally evil. I think sort of eases his conscience about the fact that it was not an entirely just treaty. Moreover, there are people who have argued the Treaty of Versailles was eminently just. The Germans and Austrians and Hungarians and the others got exactly what they deserved. They were evil countries that were trying to trample on the Western democracies. So I think Wilson, you know, definitely sold himself that bill of goods. And even with the distribution of food stuff after the war, I think, as Arthur Link points out in his biography of Wilson, Wilson's position was that the people who fought on our side should be fed first. The other people, you know, if they landed up on the other side, were necessarily evil. You know, the Croatians weren't as good as the Serbs because the Serbs fought with us. So I think his moral righteousness allowed him to believe that the Treaty of Versailles was not really a bad deal, considering that the side they had fought represented total evil.
I'm pretty sure Paul Johnson, a historian both of us are familiar with, said in his book Modern Times, I think he took the position that the Treaty of Versailles was actually not so bad.
And right.
I think that's part of his general tendency to be a contrarian.
Well,
and
no,
sometimes,
I don't think it's to be a contrarian.
He's a British, imperialist.
A British imperialist who hates the Germans. He seems to buy into the Fisher thesis, although he offers absolutely no evidence for why it is correct or why Fisher's claims are correct. He just accepts it. And another one is Victor Davis Hanson, who thinks they treat...
Who's much worse. I can enjoy a lot of what Paul Johnson
right.
has written on other topics.
Right.
I just can't enjoy Victor Davis Hanson on any level.
Because he's a monomaniac. You know, it's the Anglo-American world is good and democratic, and the Germans and Russians are evil. Or something like that. And and he even pushes us back, Kagan, to the ancient world. So the Athenians are fighting, are their precursors of Anglo-American democracy, and the Spartans are the German heavies, 2,400 years ago. So, I mean, it's impossible to read Kagan, unless you accept his prejudices, which neither one of us does.
That's right. In fact, before I forget about Paul Johnson, I remember back around the time, I think it was around the time of the Persian Gulf War of 1991, he had a cover story on National Review, I'll never forget the title, What the World Needs Now, Western Imperialism.
Right, right.
Yeah, great. That's just what we all need. And I was thinking to myself, I had too much disposable income.
Right.
What can I blow it on that will accomplish nothing? Would you say Donald Rumsfeld is a Wilsonian?
Not really. I think he's pretty much of a kind of technician, a Washington bureaucrat who's sort of fascinated by the use of force. But the neoconservatives, who are, in a sense, the ultimate Wilsonians, did like him during the Iraq War. But I just don't see that mindset in Rumsfeld.
I was just wondering because he didn't speak of war entirely as an instrument of the advancement of American interests, although he did speak of it that way. He did also talk about liberation and how wonderful
right,
it is,
right.
And because he was trying to soothe us when things started to turn sour. He said, "Well, you know, the liberation of a people can be, you know, sometimes a messy process."
Right.
He was saying so. He did push that, and I wondered, was that just for public consumption?
Yes, I think it was for public consumption, and also he was availing himself of the rhetoric, one might say, of American international relations. You're supposed to say that because American international relations has been predicated on Wilsonianism for many, many decades. So, you know, when Johnson, you know, was bombing Vietnam, you know, he spoke about bringing democracy to the Mekong Delta. I mean, you're supposed to use that. I mean, I remember Kissinger complained that, you know, that this is a little silly. They always talk about democracy and this. And then he had to sort of backtrack and say, well, of course, this is our ultimate aim. But, you know, in the meantime, we have to do something else. I always like to point out that when Mussolini attacked Ethiopia in 1936, he spoke about bringing progress and modern civilization to the Ethiopians. He never attacked them, by the way, with all due respect to Christopher Hitchens, who makes his claim as Monophysite Christians, you know, fighting them in the name of Roman Catholicism. I cannot come across him ever say, you know, and I've read all this fascist literature. He always appealed to progress, you know, in bringing people the gifts of modern civilization by gassing them, I suppose. So you get something that sounds like Wilsonianism in most forms of imperialism. I mean, the British imperialists toward the end sounded very Wilsonian. You know, they were in Africa to bring these people democracy and women's rights. They use the same kind of language. It's sort of the last gasp, one might say, of Western imperialism, Wilsonianism. So I think it serves that purpose, you know, as well as energizing Americans to fight wars, which we do well to stay out of.
But when the British would say things like that, is that always just a gimmick to bring people on board? Because even today, you can find people who... I had somebody on this very show who defended the British Empire on the grounds that these were obviously backward people, and you can talk about brutality all you want, but the fact is, now they have indoor plumbing, now they have infrastructure, now they have hospitals, now they have some semblance of order. I don't think that's just an afterthought. Surely that's part of the... what we'll call the warp and woof of British imperialism, in it that we are bringing something of what makes us great to these people.
Yeah, I think that's always been present in imperialism, but you know the British did not claim in the 19th century, you know, during the height of imperialism, that they were bringing democracy or human rights or this sort of thing. They may have you know prohibited the burning of widows on the pyres of their dead husbands, or tried to end the slave trade. But it was fairly limited, and they assumed that cultures were simply different. You know, the British could bring some gifts of civilization to other parts of the world, but they pretty much, you know, had to leave things as they are. But the missionary spirit, you know, that is tied up or attached to the notion of modern democracy, or that this is a perfect form of government which suits everybody. I think this really comes later. Together with something else that I came across about 25 years ago, that, you know, you have American academics who at one point were given the job of writing constitutions for other countries. You know, this was their job, you know, constitutions that will look like our constitution, and not the one that, of course, was, you know, written by Hamilton and Madison and Jay, but the one that we have right now. So I think this is a kind of, this is another, one might say, manifestation of the Wilsonian spirit, you know, that we can make other countries just like us by giving them, you know, the appropriate constitutional document.
You mentioned in your article a thesis common to some historians, and I remember, for the life of me, I can't remember the name of the author, but I remember reading a book in graduate school that made this thesis that in the 20th century, the world's choice is really between Lenin and Wilson.
Right.
These are the two polar opposites. And it's not quite as it's not quite the same thing as Hillary versus Bush, because at least I can identify a difference between Lennon and Wilson. But for heaven's sake, is that those are my choices? It's two forms of international crusading. That's it. You pick the kind of crusading you want, and that's your choice.
Yeah, unfortunately, this may be correct. I know that John Lukacs makes this argument, and other there's another person who wrote. His name just actually escapes my mind right now, but he was a Marxist. And this choice may, in fact, be the one that we face. Lukacs, though, has an interesting argument about this, that the Wilsonian choice may not be, you know, international democracy and crusading. It may also be nationalism, you know, the self-determination of countries. So Lukacs has argued that Mussolini is the child of Wilson, because he represents the option of national self-determination as opposed to the internationalism of Lenin. But I think you're correct. I think that this is certainly the way, let's say, neoconservatives and other American liberal internationalists see the world, the way they saw it by the end of the Cold War, that it was, you know, essentially Wilson against Lenin. And we Americans, you know, as global Democrats, are the heirs of Wilson.
Well, as I think I may have said in the last time you were here, the foreign policy difference that we're allowed to have in the U.S. is between basically neocons and realists.
Yes.
And this is supposed to be a vast chasm separating these two positions, because the neocons supposedly want to spread, you know, as you say, democracy around the world, and democracies are less likely to go to war with each other and this and that. And the realists are people who say we should not be going to war out of a concern for women's rights around the world or voting rights or anything, but simply to defend American interests. But, well, regardless, the fact is most of the time, I mean, not all the time, but most of the time, they both favor the intervention just for their own reasons. So what difference does it make what their reasons are? But secondly, are they being sincere? Are the neocons really being sincere when they say we just want to spread democracy around the world? Because it seems like when they've done it, the regimes that have resulted have been so grotesque that even they themselves have to think maybe this was a bad idea.
Yeah, I think they do believe this, though it's usually filtered through all kinds of prejudices and ethnic attachments, so that, you know, whatever Israel does to extend its influence, it's doing in the name of democracy. Whoever opposes Israel, you know, just has made up grievances. We have to pretend that, you know, 800,000 or more Palestinians were not expelled. They just were driven by totalitarian leaders to leave their homes, you know. So, I mean, a lot of what they tell you is simply based on their own ethnic prejudice. They obviously hate the Germans no matter what the Germans do. They don't much like the Russians. It's pretty obvious that they carry with them a lot of ethnic baggage, but I think at some level they do believe their own nonsense. You know, they believe that other countries have to be made to look like the United States, and not just like, you know, the way the United States was at the time of founding, but, you know, we must have gay rights. You know, that this is a new non-negotiable conservative, in quotation, demand. That, you know, Putin is a bad guy, or Audubon in Hungary because they don't have gay rights. They don't encourage gay marriage, or, you know, gay fraternizing or something like that. So much of what they consider democracy is sort of a kind of updated version. It's whatever we're now doing in the United States is democracy. And I think at some level they believe this. I mean, you know, if you read someone like John Podoretz, for instance, which I do usually with a barf bag around, but, you know, what he tells you is that, you know, we have to stand up for democracy, gay rights, women's rights, whatever. But, you know, he also is loathes the Germans, adores the Israelis. There are all of these prejudices that do operate within this Weltanschauung. But I think at some level the guy really believes what he's telling you, which I think, by the way, makes them more dangerous. You know, if you're only a person with an ethnic hang-up, you could say that's, you know, some Frenchman who fought in World War II doesn't like the Germans or whatever it is, or some Englishman doesn't like somebody else. We understand that, you know. Margaret Thatcher never quite got over Kaiser Wilhelm. She was like always denouncing the Germans. And well, we understand that there are certain national allegiances and certain national enmities. But I think in the case of the neoconservatives, it is wrapped up with this worldview that is based on the assumption that we can bring democracy to, and should be bringing democracy. And democracy must be defined as the latest version of democracy as it exists in the United States in our allies, so-called allies, which are really our satellites. By the way, I do think realism does represent a counterpoint to Wilsonianism. The problem, it would seem to me, is that all the energy, you know, is on one side. It's on the liberal internationalism. Yeah. So that somebody like Rand Paul may have started out as a genuine realist, and he still sounds to be the most sensible, you know, of these people in international relations when I listen to them. It's just that he's under tremendous pressure all the time, to love Bibi, B, to say, I want democracy for other people, C, to support wars which all good American patriots would want, you know, and so forth. The Republican media are hysterically in favor of American military intervention. So in order for Rand Paul to stay in a political race for the presidency, it is certainly necessary as a realist to sound similar to the other side. So although I think realism does have value, intrinsic value as a counterpoint, the realist position never gets played out. That's the problem.
Well, and also, I think it has I'm not saying deserved, but it has a certain air of moral superiority to it, in the same way that leftism generally, domestically, has an air of moral superiority to it. We care about the poor, you don't.
Yeah.
We care about workplace safety, you don't. When the other side's view can't be fit onto a bumper sticker. It's a little bit more involved.
Right.
There's more nuance to it, but nobody wants to hear that. So, and likewise, you could say to the neocons, you have screwed up every society you've touched in the past 15 years. Doesn't seem to matter because they use magic words like democracy, and somehow that means that it's okay that we displace 2 million people from Iraq, or that, you know, that all these other things can be just brushed aside as the unfortunate consequences of our wonderful intentions. Go ahead.
You know, they also have lots and lots of money and media exposure.
Yeah,
they can write in the national newspapers, the so-called opposition paper, the Washington Post. They can dominate. They can write the New York Times. There's no limit to their influence and power. So this is another reason why they can impose their will on opposition.
Paul, let's take just a moment to thank our sponsor. This week I caught up with Peter Schiff, whose precious metals company, Schiff Gold, I use for all my precious metals purchases, to ask him about the brand new free report that they've just released, The Powerful Case for Silver, which you can read at tomwoods.com/silver. Here's a snippet of that conversation. Peter Schiff, why of all possible things I should spend my money on, should I be spending money to accumulate some silver?
Well, you know, silver historically has been a monetary metal. It has a special place, certainly in American history. It's in the Constitution, gold and silver, legal tender. And I think there's going to be a crisis in paper money, and silver is going to be a safe haven investment. You can't just own gold. And I think in certain circumstances, silver may work better than gold in exchanges. And so Americans should have money invested in both precious metals. They are historically been used as money, and I think they will be used as money again.
Check out that free report at tomwoods.com/silver. I want to say something briefly about World War I specifically, because when I wrote about this, I guess it was 11 years ago now, in the Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, I was trying to show that Wilson, for all his rhetoric about being disinterested and being neutral, everybody knows he obviously had a double standard, because he loved the British and he hated the Germans.
Right.
Anyone can see that.
Right.
And so I said that obviously neither policy should have been adopted, but the British had the starvation blockade of the Germans, which is the half the time left out context of the German submarine warfare.
Right.
It wasn't that the Germans just arbitrarily adopted that policy. They're being starved to death on purpose.
Right.
So
right.
But okay, so when I talked about that, and I talked about how many people died by some estimates in of malnourishment or whatever, I was accused by Max Boot of, which every time I hear the name Max Boot, I think about that George Orwell image of a boot stomping on a face forever.
Right.
But Max Boot in the Weekly Standard basically accused me of sympathizing with the Kaiser. Like, they have only one way of approaching people on this,
yeah,
and that's always to accuse them of sympathizing with the bad guy.
More specifically with the Germans. They hate the Germans.
Boy, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're, because of the Holocaust. The reality was, in World War I, most Jews throughout the world supported the Central Powers. There were hundreds of thousands of Jews kicked out of Eastern Europe by the Russian army, which went into Austrian Germany, where they were protected. Wait a minute, Paul, hold on for a minute.
I didn't realize that about most of the Jews supporting the Central Powers. Does that help to account for why the Balfour Declaration occurred when it did?
No, the Balfour Declaration was different. They were afraid of losing Jewish support because the Germans were trying to woo Jewish support by making vague promises of a Jewish homeland. But it is true that, you know, most of the Jews in the world were fighting for the Central Powers and were sympathetic. They were certainly anti-Russian, but they were sympathetic to the Central Powers. Remember, Austria-Hungary was, you know, had protected Jews throughout Eastern Europe. And in Germany, although there was, you know, some persistent anti-Semitism, the kind of Jews had done very well in the course of the 19th and early 20th century. So in order to outbid the other side, they offered the Balfour Declaration. But I thought you were surprised to discover that the Russian army displaced all these Jews, which they did, mostly in Poland, eastern Poland, Galicia, other places as the army came through there. And the Jews are all going to flee westward. Many land up in Germany. And this fuels anti-Semitism between the war, because the German Jews were living there. They were like Germans. Eastern European Jews were culturally and linguistically very different. Many of them will end up in Hungary as well. This, unfortunately, plays into the hands of anti-Semitic groups in the interwar period. But there had been an enormous displacement of Jews because of the Russian army. And the Germans and Austrians protected the Jews.
At one point in your article, and of course I'm linking to the article and to some other topics that we talked about in some book titles, today's show notes page is tomwoods.com/496, so people can read this, but you reference Kagan, who apparently is of the view that the German Kaiser and Hitler and Stalin, the three of them were basically part of one great American crusade. Like, they're all moral equivalents.
Yes, they are.
Portrayed them as. I mean, that's obviously false. And George Kennan even said in the mid-1940s that if we could just have had the Kaiser back,
right,
and not have destabilized anything, obviously the world would be much better.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think he was horribly inept in international affairs. He was not a villain. But there is a book by a man named John Roll, who was really, you know, the ultimate example of a self-hating German, who did a biography trying to, it's a several thousand page biography trying to compare the Kaiser to Hitler. The problem is many of the statements that the Kaiser makes are taken out of context or just garbled. He has never struck me as any kind of villain, but rather horribly inept in international affairs, though, you know, a decent ruler at home. Kagan assumes the Fisher thesis. In fact, most of the neocons and Straussians do.
And, okay, tell people what the Fisher thesis
well,
is.
Fisher argues that the World War I was caused by a premeditated German plan to create a great empire, German empire, by swallowing up most of Eastern Europe, by making France almost into a third world country, occupying the eastern part of France, taking Belgium and other territories, and that the Germans launched the war, which they know will be a European-wide war, because they think they can, you know, vastly expand their empire and reduce others to, one might say, almost to serfs within a great German German imperial structure that they were going to build, which would be some kind of proto-Nazi dictatorship. There is virtually no evidence for anything that Fisher writes. And I've seen just about every page of his work, Griff nach der Weltmacht, Germany's Bid for World Power, I've seen it refuted multiple times. You know, and I've also seen evidence that he has twisted statements made by von Moltke, who's the German commander, and others. And what he takes, you know, sort of desperation and ineptitude on the part of the Germans, and sees this as, you know, part of something very different, a kind of imperialist arrogance, which led to what was a an intended war. European-wide war. One of the curious things is that Fisher never looks at what the other countries are doing, because anything he accuses the Germans of doing, like having war plans, you exist on the other side. The other sides, certainly the British, were looking for a fight. Churchill was looking for a fight. Poincaré in France was. And if you read a book by Sean McKeegan that came out a few years ago, on Russia in World War I, it shows that the Russians planned to attack Germany in 1914 when they assembled 1 million men on the German and Austrian-Galician border on August, they were by August 1st, 1914. The Germans were one of the last to mobilize their army. So, I mean, obviously, they were not the only players. and their argument that they had been encircled by the other side was perfectly correct. I mean, they did jump the gun, and they acted disastrously in Belgium, but they certainly were not the only. They were certainly not more responsible for the war than the French or the Russians, or the Serbs. And I think the British play at least as much of a role in the road leading up to the war as the Germans. But the Fisher thesis is simply accepted face value by most neoconservatives, and certainly by Max Boot, because of their revulsion for the Germans, because of World War II and the Holocaust.
Paul, if people want to read more about this, obviously they should read this article of yours and some of your other work, but if they want to get a sense of Wilsonianism and specifically get a good sense of the correct way to understand World War I, what can you recommend in terms of books?
Well, okay, I was going to recommend...
In English, preferably.
Preferably in English. In English, that's tough. I was going to recommend a book, by the way, that, that I'm working on right now, a book of essays, mostly on World War I, dealing with this. There is a very good essay by our friend Ralph Rako.
That's right.
On Churchill, and I think it is indispensable reading. There is a piece by Murray Rothbard on the United States in World War I that I strongly recommend. There's a book by a man named Walter Karp on American intervention in the war, which is very good. This book by Sean McKeegan, which was published by Belknap Press at Harvard a few years ago, I think it came out about 4 years ago, is certainly worth reading. It's on Russian World War I. The best work I have seen on World War I in the English language are the essays and text of Harry Elmer Barnes. I mean, it's better than just about anything else that I've read in English.
But some people would say that Barnes, because he was writing on World War I in the 1920s, is out of date now. He didn't have access to the sources we've got.
I do not. This to me is a nonsense argument. Most of the sources that I've seen that have come out since then would seem to argue in favor of what he's saying. My only criticism of Barnes is he's insufficiently critical of the British role, and Edward Grey and Churchill, who were certainly warmongers in this period, and were, you know, preparing for an inevitable confrontation with Germany, which was their continental rival. But on the French and Russian role, I think he's excellent. McKeegan, by the way, does use documents that were made available after the fall of the Soviet Empire, and everything he shows just confirms what Barnes says about the belligerent intentions of the Tsarist government in 1914.
Okay, well, that's interesting to hear, because I've heard Barnes dismissed on those grounds.
Well, one of the reasons Barnes has been dismissed is that he's a Nazi atrocity minimizer after the Second World War. And I think you...
Yeah, that really surprised me.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does surprise me, because he is certainly not writing from, you know, a pro fascist point, Nazi point of view. I mean, if you read his work on the earlier stuff, it's clear that he is a kind of command of the moderate left who is writing. I think he just became so sick of war propaganda, he went off in the other direction.
Yeah, yeah, that was my feeling as well. Well, one thing I would add also by Ralph Rako is in a collection of essays that he has called Great Wars and Great Leaders, A Libertarian Rebuttal. He actually starts off with a chapter on the coming of World War I.
Right.
And he assesses the different arguments as to who was to blame the most and so on. So, and he talks about the steps and the historical events that occurred. So I'm going to link to that also. This is going to be the most important and a chock-full show notes page ever, tomwoods.com/496. Well, when your book on fascism comes out, I guess in the relatively near future, I hope you'll come back and we can return to the subject of fascism, which is always, in a macabre way, kind of fun to discuss.
Yes, the book will be out in mid-November, so any time afterwards would work.
All right, we'll definitely do that. Thanks for your time today, Paul.
Okay, bye.
And that is it for today. TomWoods.com/496 is the show notes page. But equally important, ContraKrugman.com. Come on now, check that baby out. Let your friends know that help is on the way. It's going to be a lot of fun. I'll have more announcements about Contra Krugman coming up in the near future. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.